healthcare, and human exceptionalism. Now on A View from the Bunker. $2.5 trillion a year. That's one estimate of the cost of the Obamacare proposals working their way through Congress right now. But the real cost may be much, much higher than that. I'm talking about the human cost. Joining us this week is a senior fellow in human rights and bioethics at the Discovery Institute, the author of 11 books, most recently The Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World, an author whose work has appeared in New York Times, Wall Street Journal, USA Today, many other publications around the world, and perhaps most important, the Secondhand Smoke blog, which focuses on bioethics and human exceptionalism. We welcome back to the bunker Wesley J. Smith. Wesley, it's good to talk with you again.
Good talking to you again, too. How are you?
Doing fine, doing fine. The move to Indiana was good for body and soul. And
all right.
Getting close to family.
Wait till winter comes.
Yeah, well, you know, this global warming thing they tell us is going to keep it from getting too bad. Yeah, yeah. So the proposals that have been working their way through Congress, we're not really sure what the final form of this health care reform is going to take, but you've been tracking this through its steps at Secondhand Smoke. What concerns you most about the health care proposals that are being debated by the United States Congress?
I think the problem that I think is most acute has to do with the concept of rationing and the taking the cost of this health care proposal out of the hides of senior citizens. Sarah Palin talked about death panels. I think that was an overstatement, certainly. And she talked about the plan being evil, which I definitely think was an overstatement. However, I think her concern is very legitimate in the sense that you have these cost control boards that are planned, centralized cost-benefit boards, which could very easily descend into healthcare rationing, meaning rather than saying, as President Obama has said, well, if a blue pill and a red pill can both help and the blue pill's cheaper, let's go with the blue pill, as if that isn't already being done. I mean, I sometimes will take Ambien because I travel a lot, and if I want brand name Ambien, it's $150 from my insurance company. If it's generic, it's $10. I mean, that kind of thing is already being done. But the real fear, if you take a look at the people who are around Barack Obama, the people who are his closest advisors on health care, people like Ezekiel Emanuel, who's a bioethicist at the National Institutes of Health, the brother of President Obama's chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, people like Cass Sunstein, who is going to be the regulations czar for the Obama administration. These are people who have written extensively and who very clearly have a view that healthcare rationing is probably necessary, certainly cost controls, and that it would be acceptable to treat some classes of human beings different than other classes of human beings with regard to access to care. And so it's a real problem. Secondly, this is going to be paid for so far. I mean, we'll see. I mean, he talks about President Obama efficiencies and so forth. You're never going to get that kind of efficiencies. But he has mentioned a $500 billion cut from Medicare, cuts in payments to hospitals, cuts in payments to doctors and so forth. That's going to make it much harder for senior citizens to get quality care. And so you see that that there's a real problem in the sense of, I think, that the people who need health care the most are the ones who are being targeted to perhaps have their access restricted based on a cost-benefit analysis or a quality-of-life analysis, and that's very, very disturbing.
So who, in your opinion, has the most to be concerned about with these proposals?
I'd say senior citizens and people with profound cognitive impairments. You know, in bioethics, many in the mainstream movement, the people who would have somebody like President Obama's ear don't believe that being a human being is morally relevant. What matters is whether one earns a classification of personhood, which means having sufficient cognitive capacities. So we've seen Ezekiel Emanuel, for example, support the idea that healthcare is a basic fundamental is basic and a fundamental good that should be supplied by society. But if people can't actually give back to society, that it may not be basic. And the example he gave were people with dementia, Alzheimer's disease. So I think that those who are the weakest, those who are the defenseless, those who are unable to supposedly contribute to society, can very easily, in a zero-sum game that this kind of nationalized health care would seem to represent, be looked upon by others as saying, well, why should they get so much of this money, so many of these resources? And they could find themselves in real trouble. I hate to be anecdotal, but I was at a party last night, and I was talking to some very liberal people, a geriatrician, as it were, and another person, and I discussed something that out of my life, where I'd represented a woman pro bono as an attorney. I'm an attorney whose husband had Alzheimer's, and an ethics committee was meeting because a doctor basically wanted to pull his feeding tube. And the wife was saying, no, my husband, he's a devout Christian, and he would want a feeding tube. She'd already agreed to no antibiotics if he had pneumonia. She'd agreed to a do not resuscitate order if he had a cardiac arrest. But she did not want him forced out of life by cutting off food and water. And the doctor was livid that his will was being thwarted, as it were. Well, I won't go into the entire details, but we were able to make it so that a different doctor took over the care, and the man lived for 3 more years. And I remember I mentioned to these two very liberal people, one a physician who cares for elderly people, that the wife called 3 years later, her husband had died, and she was so pleased that his values had been honored and that he had not been pushed out of the lifeboat, as it were. And both of these people said, well, that's not a good result. Look at all the money that cost for those 3 years. What benefit was he to society? And my jaw dropped. Are we really getting to the place now, particularly among liberals who are supposed to believe in universal human equality, are we really getting to the place now where if you cannot give back, you're unwanted? If we're going down that road, we are looking for very serious trouble, because there are an awful lot of people out there, people who are with serious cognitive incapacities, very developmentally disabled people, children, people with dementia and so forth. Are we going to just decide, well, let's cut through these wards and these nursing homes and get rid of them because they cost us too much? That is the implication of the kind of thinking that I experienced at that party. I'm not saying that's what Obamacare would do, but it begins to, I believe, Obamacare puts us on the road to the kind of idea where some people will be deemed not worthy of the money spent to keep them going, to sustain their lives, and even if they want that treatment, then that's too bad. We'll give them the pain pill, as our president put it. So this is a very serious concern about universal human equality and how we view the most weak and vulnerable among us.
Now, you write often at your blog, Secondhand Smoke, about personhood theory, and you made reference to it in that response. Can you summarize?
Let me just say, to get to my blog, it's WesleyJSmith.com.
Right, and then we'll put a link to that and your work in our show notes at PIDradio.com.
Great, thanks.
Personhood theory, what is that?
Personhood theory comes out of bioethics, and it started with Joseph Fletcher who's probably the most influential American philosopher of the last half of the 20th century. I mean, a lot of your listeners are thinking, no, who cares about philosophy, and I understand that thought. But we have to care about it because from philosophy come ideas, policies, and actions. And Joseph Fletcher, writing in 1972 in the Hastings Center Report, which is the most prestigious bioethics journal in the world, said that we should not look at all human beings as having equal worth. He said that's silly. Some human beings have greater value than others. And he said people have to earn their humanhood. And he created this list, like you have to be self-aware, you have to have memory, the ability to communicate, these kinds of things. Now, because you're talking about human beings, what happened in bioethics is rather than talking about humanhood, because biologically, obviously, we're talking about human beings, they created this subject called personhood. Now, most people would think that a human being and a person are synonyms, mm-hmm. not in bioethics, or at least not the mainstream view. In the mainstream view, to be a person, whether you're an animal or a human being, you have to be, like, for example, self-aware over time or able to enjoy or value your own life, these kinds of cognitive capacities. So that if you don't have those capacities, have not developed them yet, or have lost them, you have lower value than those who have them. It's called the quality of life ethic. And so there is such a thing in this view as the human non-person. All unborn life are non-persons, which means that, at least to some bioethicists, unborn life should be able to be used instrumentally because they don't have the same They do not rise to the moral status and are not full members of the moral community as persons. Newborn infants, Peter Singer, many of your listeners may recall, from mm-hmm. Princeton, says that a newborn infant can be killed, actually, because if that newborn infant does not have these attributes of being able to value his or her own life or be self-aware, then that life isn't as valuable as somebody else's life who would be wrong to kill. Somebody like Harry Shiloh has been denigrated as a non-person. And you even see in many of the major journals in bioethics and medicine that people like Terry Schiavo should be harvested for their organs, because they talk about redefining death. The idea of the loss of personhood is actually like death, and so they can be used instrumentally. That's not happening in the hospitals. I have to emphasize that. But there's talk about it, mm-hmm. and it's important to understand. They'll say, well, what's the talk? Well, in the 1980s, there was talk about taking feeding tubes away from people like Terry Schiavo, which at one time was unthinkable, and now we know it's done every day in all 50 states, people who are conscious and unconscious alike. And so these ideas become very insidious. So if being human is not what gives value, if human exceptionalism, as I call it, no longer applies, that is the sanctity and equality of human life, that once you're, if you're a member of the human species, you have a status, at least a certain level of equality that cannot be taken away from you. If that is gone, then you no longer have universal human rights. If you have to earn your status by being self-aware over time, just as that example, well, those people who may not have those capacities or have not yet attained them have less value, and it's the end of universal human rights. And we are already seeing in the embryonic stem cell debate, the therapeutic cloning idea, of very nascent human life being used as a mere instrumentality or a natural resource. The idea that we can actually destroy human life and use the cells from those nascent lives for our own benefit. Well, it's not going to stop at, once you accept that principle, it's not going to stop at early embryos in a test tube or on a petri dish. You've begun to see advocacy in bioethics, it's still a minority view, for fetal farming. That is, let's gestate, because they're not persons, remember, let's gestate embryos into, say, 3 or 4 or 5 month fetal stage in an artificial environment, and we'll be able to experiment on them instead of on animals, or we'll be able to take their organs. This has even been written about in the Huffington Post, which is the largest website on the left, and is deemed respectable.
Mm-hmm.
So these ideas are really beginning to bubble forth, and with those ideas, the idea of healthcare reform and of letting bioethicists who basically hold these views become the expert deciders of who gets care becomes very problematic, because the thing I think I've been pounding on is that made people up in the high levels of the university, the high academics, the Yales, the Harvards, these professors, they don't think like most people. I call them the big-brained. You know, they are the ones who are willing to very intellectually decide who has value and who doesn't. Meanwhile, you know, Charlie over the barber is trying to make sure that his grandmother is treated properly in a hospital after her stroke. And you know, the people in healthcare, I'm rambling a little bit here, but the people who work in the trenches of healthcare are what's keeping it moral. But if you look behind the people in healthcare, the doctors, the nurses, and so forth, who are under tremendous strain in terms of finances, and they're under strain now in terms of the ethics of medicine that are being taught in the universities, this idea that, well, you know, we don't have enough resources, so some of us will have to go, is very dangerous. And personhood theory is a huge part of that.
Well, I think it's very important to understand the underlying ethical and philosophical thought that's driving this so-called reform. And ultimately, if you want to really speculate far out there, just look at movies like Soylent Green or The Island for where that may ultimately lead in the distant future. But in the here and now, on a nuts and bolts level, what kind of lessons can we learn from the Brits and the Canadians who are struggling with their own nationalized healthcare systems?
Well, in the UK, the National Health Service is literally in a meltdown. And on my blog, if people want to do a search, I have a continual series of entries. There's scores of entries now, NHS meltdown. We just recently saw a story out of the UK, for example, that women are giving birth in toilets, in elevators, in ambulances, because there aren't enough beds in the National Health Service to accommodate women giving birth. From Canada, which, you know, these are not poor countries, by the way, England and Canada. In Canada, sometimes they actually fly women in labor to the United States to give birth. It's a very worrying thing, because when you centralize and have the, quote, public option, at some point you begin to run out of money, particularly since you then have a lot of different people competing with each other for how the money should be spent. So you see a collapse in a lot of the quality of care in the NHS. You see long lines for things like MRIs and important testing in Canada. You know, if you're relatively healthy, it's kind of like being in an HMO. You know, some of these systems can work fine. But when you have serious expensive conditions, that's when you begin to see the breakdowns. And in Canada in particular, you have a lot of people who can't even get their own doctors, because the payments to doctors are so a cut that doctors aren't taking new patients. And so you have millions of Canadians, even though they have a guaranteed right to health care, who don't have their own doctors. And guess where they go? The emergency room.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think we have to also say, that being said, it would be a real tragedy if out of this debate we're having now, let's assume that the public option is stopped and let's say this Obamacare idea doesn't go any further. I don't want to see in 1993 when Hillary Care, again an attempt to remake the entire healthcare system, throw out the baby with the bathwater, accrue power into the federal government. It would be a shame if that was stopped and then nothing else was done. After 1993, even though there was still a need for reform, oh, Hillary Care lost, well, it's over. Well, it shouldn't be over. There are things that need to be done to make sure that people who don't have health insurance have a better chance of getting it, that people who have pre-existing conditions have some way to make sure they get coverage. And I think that we do have to work as a nation to try to expand access to health care. We also have to try to make sure we end up graduating more physicians to be primary caretakers. I think we need to allow physicians' assistants and certified nurse practitioners to take more responsibility for normal patient covering, like doing physicals, monitoring people who might have chronic conditions under the supervision of a physician. I think the idea of having health clinics in malls, so that if a mother had her kid spikes 101-degree fever and she's concerned, she can go into the mall and maybe pay $50 and make sure that kid doesn't have something serious. I think there are things we need to do and can do without deciding to remake the entire healthcare system, which will be a disaster because just bureaucratically, it won't be. You can't administer it.
How influential is this strain of philosophical thought, personhood theory, in bioethics right now?
It's the predominant view, and it's not the universal view, but it's the predominant view of the people who teach at Princeton, Yale, Harvard. If you take a look at the mainstream bioethicists who are out there being trained to work and advise hospital bioethics committees, there is a quality of life ethic that many, many of these people have accepted. And that's why I think some of your listeners may have experienced it, where elderly people might who have no cognitive incapacities will be treated one way, but if they have serious cognitive incapacities, they might be treated a different way. So I think it's a real, real concern. People with disabilities are also worried, because if you start to accept the quality of life ethic and you start saying, well, what matters is your ability to, you know, climb rocks and contribute to society and not have to be dependent. Well, there are a lot of people with disabilities who can't do those things, and you begin to see them being looked at as, and they're expensive to care for. They begin to worry a little bit about, well, you know, how are we going to be cared for in such a system? On the other hand, a lot of times, because they can't get care unless they qualify for Medicaid, they're being pulled in both directions, because there are a lot of people with disabilities who have serious medical conditions that if they don't have jobs or if they have low-paying jobs and that doesn't provide health insurance, they might not have health insurance. So there are things we need to do, but we have to do it from a human equality perspective. If we keep a sanctity of life ethic, a human exceptionalism ethic, the way we fund healthcare won't be as important. But in a milieu in which some people are looked as having greater importance than others or greater value, then funding also becomes important, because you want to make sure that we don't then apply those invidious discriminatory beliefs against people in the way we provide coverage for medical care that's needed.
Absolutely. One of the topics that you cover regularly at Secondhand Smoke at WesleyJSmith.com is, as I mentioned, human exceptionalism. And that leads to a topic I want to talk about here regarding your upcoming book in our last few minutes. The idea that animals should have rights equivalent to those of humans, and your forthcoming book, A Rat is a Pig, is a Dog, is a Boy, if I understand correctly, kind of explores that that thought, that type of thinking. What is going on out there with this movement to equate animals with humans on a legal basis?
Right. Well, you see an awful lot happening. First, a lot of people use, particularly in the media, the word animal rights is used very loosely. So it's almost a synonym in people's minds with, well, we don't want dogs treated the way Michael Vick treated those dogs, which, of course, is true.
Right.
We don't want dogs treated that way. And it is a violation of human exceptionalism to treat animals in that way, because human exceptionalism, the idea of the unique importance of human life, is a two-edged sword. One, we have unique rights because we're human beings and only because we're human beings. But secondly, we also have unique duties. We're the only species in the known universe that is a moral species and who can be held to account for moral, have moral accountability. So we have a duty to treat animals properly and humanely. We have a duty as human beings, and solely because of human beings, to treat the environment properly and keep and conserve resources and maintain cleanliness and make sure we don't wipe species off the earth. And prepare to keep the earth in good shape for our posterity and so forth. No other species has those duties. But animal rights is actually not about that. That the idea of treating animals properly and humanely is animal welfare. Animal rights, properly understood, is an ideology. It is a belief system. As you pointed out, it creates a moral equivalency between human beings and animals. And this is another way in which the unique importance of human life is under attack. In animal rights ideology, being human is not what gives value. It is the ability to feel pain or to suffer. Thus, since a cow can feel pain and a human can feel pain, we're equal in the sense of moral value. And thus, a cattle ranching is the same thing as human slavery. Using mice and other animals in vital medical research, it's like Mengele in the camps. And so you saw people with the ethical treatment of animals for several years ran a pro-vegetarian campaign, and I certainly don't care if people want to be vegetarian. If they feel it's, if it has a face, don't eat it. That's human exceptionalism in action. Somebody acting on their morality to not eat a natural food for humans, which is meat.
Mm-hmm.
If people want to give that up based on moral views, that's a human, only humans would do that. But they, in the Holocaust on Your Plate campaign, they literally stated that the leather couch and handbag is the equivalent of the human, is of the lampshade made with human skin in the camps.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anybody who, I've been to Auschwitz and I've been to Birkenau. I've seen what those places were. I've stood in the gas chambers. I've seen the sheds people were stored in as slave laborers until they dropped. Anybody who will juxtapose a picture of dead Auschwitz victims next to a pile of dead pigs and photographs, which the Holocaust on Your campaign did, fight campaign did, has no business preaching morality to anybody. And the idea that your son is the moral equivalent of a squirrel, which is what this is odious. And it not only does it diminish humanity, is it anti-human, and the impact certainly would be anti-human, considering the great benefits we receive from proper use of animals, but it also devalues the concept of rights. If everything has rights, then the very concept of rights begins to devalue, kind of like inflation devalues currency. We are even now to the place in Switzerland that individual plants are declared to have human dignity. and in Ecuador, they've created the rights of nature that are equivalent to human rights. There is, in radical environmentalism, the deep ecology movement. We've only not only gone from being human doesn't matter, being human and being animal are the same thing, to now in the deep ecology movement, being human is the vermin species, the AIDS on the planet. We are the enemy. And so you see people advocating that human population be reduced to under a billion. And you can think about the genocidal implications of that. And so if our self, particularly for young people, if our self-definition becomes we're no better than animals and indeed we're the problem, that leads to darkness, that leads to nihilism, that leads to despair. And I think it leads to the loss of human flourishing, because I think there is a whole group of people on various levels who want us to sacrifice our own well-being to, quote, save the planet. And the people who will be hurt the most by that are the people who live in places like Africa, Bangladesh, people who have plenty of resources but have yet to develop the systems they could, by which they can develop those resources and achieve prosperity. If we decide, oh, because of global warming or too many people, we're not going to allow them to develop those resources. At the same time, we're going to say to ourselves, we have to reduce our prosperity because we are the evil rapers of the earth. Then you're going to see a tremendous increase in human misery and suffering. If you say that human beings have no intrinsic value just because we're human, and you have to earn that value, or you even go worse and say, well, we're the problem, the only consequence of that in the end can be suffering for the weak and vulnerable, and eventually perhaps even for the entire society, human society.
I think it's significant that the people who most often talk about the need to reduce population or control population are wealthy white folks. What color do you expect the people are that they're talking about when they say that there are, you know, certain classes of people we just don't want too many of? Which, you know, infamous quote attributed to Justice.
I know what you're saying, but unless people make that explicit statement, I'm not going to go there. But when you have people saying we must reduce by, say, 5 or 6 billion, and then you say, well, how are you going to do that? And they say, oh, well, voluntary birth control. Right.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
But what you do see them also yearning for are things like pandemics, mm-hmm. you know, where we get wiped out by this disease that comes. And you know, people will say, oh, well, what difference does that make? Well, let me say, Cass Sunstein, who I mentioned earlier, is going to be Barack Obama's regulations czar. He wants animals to be able to sue their owners. Another one of the people that is going to be his science advisor, believes that trees should be able to sue
mm-hmm.
people. Now, you know, of course, the trees aren't going to be doing the suing and the animals aren't going to be doing the suing because they don't understand what, and animals wouldn't understand what's happening. And, of course, trees aren't sentient. It'll be the radical environmentalists or the radical animal rights activists who'll be doing the suing with the intent of destroying human flourishing, destroying industry, destroying exploitation of resources, keeping people from ranching cattle and engaging in needed medical research and so forth. The implications and the potential outcome of these radical ideologies is anti-human, sometimes explicitly and sometimes in the implicit outcomes of the policies that would be derived from them being in charge.
This sounds like wild internet conspiracy theory, but we'll put links in the show notes to the major media reports to the quotes, specifically quotes from people like Ted Turner, who was a member of the so-called Good Club, met with David Rockefeller and Michael Bloomberg and Oprah Winfrey, interestingly enough, and Bill Gates, to talk about how to go about reducing the population of the world. The quote from, I believe, was Prince Philip, who talked about wanting to come back to Earth as a killer virus that wipes out most of humanity. Things like this. I'll send you the link to that too. I mean, again, it sounds like internet conspiracy theory, but it's all well documented that this is happening. I mean, and most of us aren't paying attention.
The danger is that we'll begin to eat our own tails. That rather than be optimistic and look forward to building a more prosperous future, we will actually begin to turn on ourselves and start undermining our own flourishing and our own prosperity and our own suffering. But the ironic thing is that the members of the elite, it never applies to them. It
right.
only applies
right.
to other people.
That's exactly the point. When will your forthcoming book, A Boy is a, or rather, A Rat is a Pig is a Dog is a Boy, when will that be available?
That will come out January the 19th. And by the way, the title comes from a quote from Ingrid Newkirk, who's the head of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, a very radical woman who has said that even if, you know, using 50,000 monkeys would find a cure for AIDS, she wouldn't support it, because would you support your daughter being researched on to find a cure for AIDS? So, I mean, this is where this leads. And her most famous quote is, "A rat is a pig is a dog is a boy. We're all equal, or we all are, have the capacity to suffer." See, the idea here is a rat is no different morally than a pig or a dog or a boy. And if we accept that that moral belief, that we are just other, just another animal in the forest, I'm afraid that's how we'll act. Give in to impulses, give up the idea of unique human duties. I mean, what's really ironic is they'll say, well, animal rights and human rights are the same, and but there will never be any duties by the animals to treat each other properly or to treat us properly. Mm-hmm. But human beings will have all the duties to treat animals properly as if they were human and each other properly, but we will not have the right to receive those from the animal world, which, of course, is because they can't understand that concept. And then what right. really fries me, Derek, is I'll talk about human exceptionalism, and people will say that's arrogant. Well, what other species has a duty to anything that can be morally enforced? None. Well, doesn't that make us exceptional? But they can't take it. They just say that's arrogant. That means it's a belief that you can do whatever you want to an animal, however you want to, that you can destroy the environment. And, of course, it's the opposite. It is the exceptionalism of the human species that gives us the duty to not do those things. And I've given speeches at colleges. And people, kids will have, young men and women will say, oh, it's arrogant, human exceptionalism, blah, blah, blah. We're not better than the animals. And I'll say, well, okay, being human is not what gives us the obligation to treat animals properly. Tell me what does. And there's never an answer.
Right,
right. Because the only answer is because we're human. And if that's the only answer, if being human is what gives us that duty, then we're exceptional. And I don't know why people want to reject that idea.
Well, we could get into the theological implications there, but that's beyond the scope of this conversation. But you're right. I mean, it's so logically incoherent. You don't even need to use a theological argument to poke a hole in the balloon. And yet, for some reason, there are people who just won't go there. It's astounding. It's a concept that most five-year-olds can understand with ease. And sure. yet, once we are so, you know, allegedly educated, a big percentage of the most influential thinkers in bioethics somehow fail to grasp the concept.
Well, sometimes you get too educated and too intellectual and you miss the common sense.
Yeah. Author, researcher, bioethicist Wesley J. Smith, the forthcoming book, A Rat is a Pig, is a Dog, is a Boy. His most recent book, The Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World, and of course the excellent Secondhand Smoke blog, which covers bioethics and human exceptionalism in depth at WesleyJSmith.com. And again, links to all of this in the show notes at PIDradio.com. Wesley, appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule today.
Thanks for talking to me. I appreciate it.
Wesley J. Smith, his blog Secondhand Smoke is one of the blogs at the First Things website. The easiest way to get to it is follow the link WesleyJSmith.com. That's WesleyJSmith.com. And I'll put a link to that in the show notes at PIDradio.com. Now, one of the things I like about Wesley is that he doesn't take a religious or theological path to arrive at his conclusions. I do. And it's encouraging to see that you can get to the same place using a secular argument. Now, why do I think there's a theological grounds or spiritual component to this argument that humans only have worth if we are contributing to society? Well, I think there's, of course, the strong possibility, shall we say, that the Apostle Paul knew what he was writing about in Ephesians 6:12 when he wrote that we wrestle not against flesh and blood. Take that at face value, and that would indicate that almost anything that takes place in the political realm on this planet is somehow influenced by the spiritual realm. That we as believers are not confronting flesh and blood enemies, but spiritual enemies. Now, whether the human actors in this drama acknowledge or are even aware of the spiritual component is irrelevant. The influence is there, and I believe that the enemy is perhaps angry that at some point in the future, humankind will be judging the spirit realm. 1 Corinthians 6, Paul writes, "Do you not know that we will judge the angels?" But again, if you try to use this argument to someone who doesn't believe in God, or perhaps believes in a God, but not the kind who actually intervenes in human affairs. You're not going to get anywhere trying to put forward a spiritual or theological argument for the exceptionalism of human beings. In other words, if they don't believe in a creator God, arguing that humans should be considered exceptional because we were created in God's image isn't going to get you very far. So again, read Wesley's blog. Now, as I record this on the evening, the tag that is, on the evening of September 6th, 2009, there are a couple of articles that Wesley has, or posts that Wesley put to his Secondhand Smoke blog that are worth noting. And first is that Section 1233 of the bill, of the health care reform bill, was written by an assisted suicide advocate who represents Oregon in the United States Congressman, Representative Earl Blumenauer, who has, at the Huffington Post, claimed credit for writing Section 1233. And quoting from his piece, "I know a little bit about this section because it's a bill that I wrote, which was incorporated into the overall legislation." Now, the original legislation that Blumenauer wrote did include government funding for assisted suicide counseling. The bill that's going through the United States Congress now makes no reference to assisted suicide, but the bill is substantially unchanged from the original proposal written by Representative Blumenauer. Again, this all fits together with this idea that quality of life is the key determinant, or the utility of life is the key determinant in whether or not healthcare should be provided or allocated by those in government with the power to do so. Since talking to Wesley last week, we also learned from the UK, which I think is a good model from which to draw some evidence about what we can expect in healthcare here in the United States. A group of doctors there wrote a letter to the Daily Telegraph, which is a newspaper based out of London. And this is a group of experts who care for terminally ill patients, have written that patients, some patients, are being wrongly judged as being close to death because under guidelines in the UK, the National Health Service guidelines allow for those doctors then to withdraw fluid and medications and just sedate the patients until they die. Okay? They withdraw medicines, they withdraw fluids, they sedate the patients, and then dehydrate them to death. However, the doctors add, the real horror of this is that sedating the patients and withdrawing fluids and medicines can disguise the fact that these patients are actually getting better. In other words, they might recover from whatever it is that landed them in the hospital in the first place. But because under National Health Service guidelines in the UK, doctors are directed to dehydrate these people to death, which is a horrible way to die. And they're sedated, I would imagine, as much for the healthcare, peace of mind of the healthcare professionals who have to deal with these patients, as it is for the comfort of the patients themselves. This is a horrible thing. And this comes less than a week after a patients association in the UK reported that up to 1 million patients had received poor or cruel care at the hands of the National Health Service. Now, bear in mind that the United States has five times the population of the United Kingdom. And I don't see any way, just, there's no logical way that it would be any easier to administer or more efficient when you're trying to administer a system five times as large as the one that is buckling under its own weight in the United Kingdom. Again, the bottom line in this debate, which seems to focus on the costs, the dollars and cents costs of treating patients under Obamacare, is that the actual argument here is human exceptionalism. WesleyJSmith.com, read his blog, stay informed on this debate, and make your opinion known to your elected officials. It may not matter, because frankly, the opposition of two-thirds of us to the bailouts of the banks and the auto companies didn't make any difference. But follow your conscience. At least you can feel good about that. Next week, God willing, we're going to talk with Jeffrey Charlotte. He's the author of the book, The Family. That's the rather secretive religious group that's behind the National Day of Prayer, but also has access in the halls of power in Washington, D.C. and around the planet. It's a Dominionist organization that Christians should be aware of, and frankly, Christians should be most upset about. Most of the criticism about this group and the revelations so far have only attracted attention, well, mainly attracted attention, I should say, from secular media. Jeffrey Charlotte, essentially infiltrated the group for a series of articles that he wrote for Harper's Magazine. He eventually expanded that research into a book, and assuming we can make connections, we have a tentative date to talk this week, and should bring you that interview next week. It should be a fascinating interview, and I look forward to reading and reviewing his book, The Family, at PIDradio.com. If you have questions that you'd like to pass on by email, questions or comments, feel free to do that at radio@peeringintodarkness.com. And don't forget, we've got a 24/7 phone line that goes direct to voicemail to take your verbal questions or comments, which we may actually play on the radio at PIDradio.com. That phone number is 317-489-9350. That's 317-489-9350. Again, that rings straight into voicemail. Leave your message, indicate your name, where you're calling from, and whether we have permission to use your voice. And we look forward to hearing from you. Until next time, thanks for listening. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.